There's a sort of clipped, sassy tone that AI writing, like LLMs produce, that is kind of like tech inflected and like a bit weird, and you can kind of identify it.
It's trying to be punchy, but also it's
like punchy, like an idiot is like trying to hit on you, you know what I mean? And they're just saying stuff.
Hi, I'm Tobias Faberkorn, and you're listening to Airlift from Berlin Review. Last month, something embarrassing happened in the English-speaking literary world. A well-respected magazine published an award-winning story, and while none of the editors noticed, many readers suspected that it was written by AI. Lauren explains the scandal, but I promise this is not another episode about how AI is killing writing. It's actually about what most writers, even the good ones, are not understanding about the new technology, and what they can do to keep writing human and even make it more interesting. Here's my conversation with Lauren Euler.
Hi, Lauren. Nice to be back.
Great to be back in the studio.
On Airlift. So there was a major scandal in the English-speaking literary world this May involving AI and cheating. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Okay, well, I love to explain a literary world scandal to people who don't know.
Tell me.
Yes. So basically, in the middle of May, this short story prize called the Commonwealth Short Story Prize, which awards a little bit of money, I think between 3,000 and 5,000 pounds, to short stories produced by unpublished or barely published writers from Commonwealth countries. Mm-hmm. I believe there are five regions. Each picks a regional winner. And then there's a big prize that has not been announced yet. Now, the Commonwealth Short Story Prize is apparently, I didn't know this, relatively well regarded as a short story prize. And as such, the regional winners are every year published online by Granta Magazine, the storied UK literary magazine. But at the same time, as with many things in the literary world, they're very prestigious, but also no one cares. Okay, so Granta publishes on their website, not in print, just on their website, the five regional winners of this Commonwealth Short Story Prize. And someone, Super Sleuth, posted something that was like, this is interesting. It seems that an AI-generated short story has won a prestigious literary prize. Yeah. And what followed were some screenshots of some pretty, what we would call purple prose, sort of, but kind of like manically purple prose, written by a guy from Trinidad and Tobago named Jameer Nazir. Mm-hmm. And he had won the Caribbean Regional Commonwealth Short Story Prize.
And there was a second story as well that was detected.
There were actually three. There were three out of the five. People became obsessed with like rooting out AI in these stories. The right-wing literary sphere that exists now. Obviously, there were some racial elements that they would like to play on, indicating kind of like woke post-colonial literature has gotten out of control and look how bad it is.
But just to get this clear, those are actual people who handed in the short stories. It's not that there is a...
It's a fictional
made-up name, like an anonymous person.
Jameer Nazir. So I believe that he has given interviews since, but this created like a total uproar, right? Mm. Lots of literary journalists try to contact him, get some quotes from him. I saw various articles, some of which are more journalistically sound than others, about people having DM'd him, DM'd other people who'd won regional prizes in this competition. Basically, it caused like a huge frenzy because everybody is obsessed with AI, and also everybody is, you know, I think like there's a desire to puncture like the bubble of literary prestige, like the teeny tiny like little area of literary prestige that still exists. Let's also talk about Granta as well, because basically, rather than people focusing on the Commonwealth Short Story Prize, which chose these winners, a lot of the burden of responsibility fell on Granta Magazine. Because their editors like publish these stories without looking further into how kind of hallucinatory, to use an AI word, they were. And then after a few days of internet frenzy where everybody was condemning Granta and condemning the Commonwealth Short Story Prize and being kind of racist, Granta then issued a quite bizarre, quite bad statement saying that they had put the winning short story through Claude, the
asking
LLM from
Anthropic,
asking it if it thought that this story was AI generated. And Claude said probably. And then the publisher of Granta basically threw up her hands and she said, it's possible we'll never know for sure if this is AI generated or not. It's just baffling.
A technical question. I mean, we've been, you know, confronted with AI generated text for almost a decade now, probably. Uh-huh. And it's true that, especially early on, it was so obvious. Mm-hmm. I'm less sure whether it is so easy to establish that something is clearly AI now. So the people that are making that assessment are basing it on clear, like, structural, stylistic elements where they say, this sounds so much like this. I'm 100% sure this must be AI because it sounds like. Is that the
assessment? Yeah, and because there are certain tics, but also there's certain, like, structural things that it does, and the way that it creates what in writing class we would call mixed metaphors, like, that don't make any sense.
Yeah.
The issue, I think, when talking about, like, literary writing and AI is that many literary writers are very bad at, like, what they do, like, naturally without AI. Like, they're just naturally quite bad. They write exactly the same kind of nonsense metaphors that people say are, like, definitely AI.
Yeah.
They love to do not this, but that constructions. They love an M dash. I remember when I was in university in like 2010 and I was in a writing class and there was a long discussion about whether we all use too many M dashes because they're so fun to use, right?
But like, you sent me that Substack piece by the writer Sam Chris that came out a couple of days ago. What's the title again? It's like, I know that you're using AI. Oh no, don't use AI or else I will come to your house,
like,
and kill you.
If you like use that. AI for your writing, yeah. I will come to your house and kill you, yes.
And so I read it in preparation and it's definitely a nice piece of writing. He has great style. He's a good critic. But he's so sure that he's able to detect AI and that AI, the flaw of AI writing is sort of like baked in the stochastical mechanism of predictive continuity in sentences, that he says exactly what you say, that the mixed metaphors and that this sort of like slightly nonsensical guesswork. He says that this is recognizable and it forever will be, and therefore, you know, stop using it because everyone sees that it's obvious. And I've been editing text for 15 years now, and it's true that sort of like analyzing the metaphors the writers uses and finding where they are sort of like off because they are combining, I don't know, imagery or elements that don't quite go together. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's right in these particular cases that he's analyzed. But on a sort of like more philosophical or theoretical level, the misuse and the non-standard use of language, of course, is what always amounts to poetry or poetic or literary use of language in general.
Right.
So I'm just skeptical of the argument that we will forever be able to detect AI writing. I think.
No, well, I'm also skeptical of it because I also think that there are lots of things that, you know, AI is trained on huge data sets of human writing. You can also sort of train your own model to do like more specific kind of writing, which means that you can get it to basically, like, people use this term AI plagiarism to mean like the use of AI and something that you claim is human generated. But actually what AI often does is literally plagiarize, like in the old fashioned way, which is it takes sentences from other pieces of writing and like puts them out as if they are something that the AI has generated itself. Mm. So it kind of like cuts out the middleman of plagiarism where like you can say, oh, I didn't actually steal that sentence from this writer. It's just the AI stole it, right? Sam Chris, in trying to make this critique, which he has made several times in several different outlets, he had a really great piece in the New York Times Magazine a few months ago about AI style. He had this great Harper's cover story about Silicon Valley, going to Silicon Valley. And he captures really well like the kind of crazy making, like hallucinatory or like the contagiousness of the hallucination aspect of AI, which is like you read something that's AI or you use AI and you're like, this is I feel insane. But he's taking for granted in a lot of these pieces that like most people would find what is produced insane. But most people do not have a unique, deep passionate relationship with language, yes, the way that Sam Chris and I do, like the way that a real serious professional writer does.
Yeah. And you mean also literary
writers. Yeah. I mean people, like, I would say, like, what distinguishes a literary writer from a journalist or someone else is that they pay attention to the nuances of language,
yeah,
and they use language to, like, create effects.
Yeah.
So
But
I think, like, most even literary writers don't do that. Like, and like, they just don't. Like, they're just not doing that. So, and they might think that they do, but they don't.
Mm.
If literary writers, critics, like if writers and people in the humanities in general would like to seriously combat the encroachment of AI, like, into our, like, tiny, like, cultural sphere, you kind of need to learn how it actually works, because everyone's like, oh, I'm sure it's good for math. Like, I'm sure it's good for this. I'm sure it's good for this. But most people don't even know how it works. And I think the primary example of this, I just wrote a very long essay about AI, a slightly different topic, but I just wrote about this. And I was quite shocked to find, while I was researching this, that many, many articles about AI and writing and AI and literature don't even understand, like, the basic premise of what happens with this technology, which is they say that it works by predicting what word is most likely to come after another word. So you have a prompt, and then it just sort of works, like, by, like, a vast predictive model.
That is what Sam Chris also said.
It's not words, it's tokens. So it's not even using, like, what, like, linguists would understand as language. Sometimes it's working with linguistic units, which is a linguistics term, but sometimes it's just working with letters. Now, at this point, and also I should say that this technology changes very rapidly. Yes. So when we're talking about this, it might not be true in 2 weeks that this is, you know, whatever.
And I think there are also emergent, at this point, there are some emergent properties of it where even the tokens-based decomposition of language or of structure is, like, one stage, but then other things happen, and I'm not sure if even the engineers who make the models are 100% sure of what happens at the even higher levels.
Yeah, they don't even really, like, yes, they don't the black even box really understand argument. How I mean, it works. I don't works.
Certainly either, but
this yeah, is like, I mean, we also don't understand how the human mind works, right? So it's kind of fair. But the thing about it is, like, the devaluation of language and of, like, meaning conveyed through language has been happening, like, before this, certainly.
Yeah.
And so, of course, there are lots of, like, people who want to be writers who then are just like, I don't really care about language as such. Like, I will just, like, I want to create some kind of phantom story or, like, phantom piece of writing that functions as a piece of writing, as literary writing, but isn't actually, that doesn't actually convey a lot of meaning. And I do think that there's lots of, like, writing that does this kind of, like, oh, it sounds cool. Like, it just sounds cool. It just sounds poetic. It sounds lyrical, right? And I think this story that Granta published by Jameer Nazir called The Serpent in the Grove, I don't even think I've said what it was called, does have this kind of, like, childish, like, delight at the sound of words that have kind of little to do with, like, the meaning of the words together.
Yeah.
Which can produce, like, interesting poetry sometimes, but usually the poets who are most successful with that strategy also, like, know what the words know how language functions, and they break the rules. Like, they know the rules before they can break them, as it were.
Yeah. That's an interesting point you make. If we zoom out of the question of literature and look at the use and meaning and status of writing in general in life, like in the way the economy or any sort of system works, it's that writing in general in so many professions, what gives you professional status and sort of, like, proves that you're doing your job is a piece of writing.
How so?
Well, I mean, okay, this comes from a German in Germany, but, like, the amount of reporting that people have to do in any sort of, like, public job in Germany, or even in companies or in universities, you have to prove to someone else that you have done this and this and this and that, and you need to write a report, for example.
Right.
So it's that kind of, that little piece of writing that is going to legitimize your professional existence.
Okay.
And in a not so far-fetched analogy, you know, the people who want to compete for the Commonwealth Prize, it's not by accident that they're competing for a literary prize, which
that will ideally
we'll give them some sort of statues, you know, and then they hand in a piece of writing. So the painful process of writing down things is often in literature, in the literary world, it shouldn't, but I think it happens, but also outside of literature, that painful process is actually only undergone by a lot of people because they need the end result, because it does something for them.
Yeah, but and also I think the thing that's sort of like perverse about it is like most of those people don't like writing and don't want to have to do these kind of reports or like summaries or, you know what I mean, for their job, and they just do it anyway. And then for these people, AI, it's my understanding, is like a total like game-changing experience where they don't have to spend hours like being so anxious about sending an email or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But with writing as a like an art form, it's like really funny because it just demonstrates the very human tendency, which is they want to be a writer without having to do any writing.
Yes.
But I also thought you were going to say, oh, you know, in bureaucracy or in sort of normal jobs, one has to produce a bunch of writing to prove, you know, their legitimacy in the role. And yeah. I'm like, oh, well, you know, for writing, you have to produce a bunch of writing, like, you know, for literature, you have to produce a bunch of writing to prove your legitimate, like the legitimacy of your like soul or like your like spirit, right? Because like, it's supposed to come from like some process of thinking philosophically, creatively, whatever, that is unique to you, whereas in bureaucracy, uniqueness is definitely like a weakness. Why am I? I'm just creating all these sort of rhyming. This is just like a ChatGPT poem. It's coming. It's uniqueness is a weakness.
But what is going to happen then? I mean, it's in academic writing, the joke is you spend 5 or 6 years of your life writing a PhD that in the end 30 people will read. So it's also writing without a readership. In literary writing, I mean, to the extent that the literary market functions, it still is the case that literary writing ideally is done for people to read it. Mm-hmm. Let's assume like the AIs will get better and better. There are all sorts of problems with that. We like the resources that are being consumed for making it more potent and powerful and so forth, but let's bracket that maybe. Let's assume like the proficiency of this text machine is going to get better and better and better and better. And as you said, you can sort of like feed and train your personal agent with your own writing, and then it emulates your style and so forth. Like, where does this lead the literary culture?
I mean, I think that there, you know, there's a huge resistance within literary culture and within like the sort of like highest tiers of literary culture to AI. If you're just listening to this podcast, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says, "Do not talk to me about AI. I will kill myself." Yeah. Like, this is how many, I think, literary people
don't
want to
talk about it anymore.
They don't want to talk about it. But it's also because it's kind of an overwhelming subject, right? And you're like, well, I can't do anything about it. And if you're, you know, are like my age, your age, you have lived through like pretty significant technological changes in your adult life, specifically the rise of social media and the complete like transformation of your day-to-day life with your cell phone. And I don't want to do that again. Like, I did it, you know what I mean? Like, we complain and resist social media so much, and now, like, it's just part of our lives. And I,
I was people thinking, are tired of yet another technological
this is not how the forces of history work, and not how technology works at all. But you still are like, why couldn't we just stop at email? Like, why didn't we, like, email and Google Maps, you know? I think a lot of people would agree. These are things that definitely improved everyone's lives. But like text messaging, I don't even know. Maybe having a phone that you could call someone if you're late, that's kind of useful. I don't even know. And I love text messaging. But like, if we went back to 1999 and had that level of technological advancement.
Oh, yeah, the peak of human
civilization. Wouldn't it be awesome? It would be so sick. So like, I think, you know, you feel like it's just you're like, again, I can't do the social media thing. It sucks. Social media sucks. And there is this kind of futile resistance, I think, among literary people, especially because they don't understand how technology works and they don't want to learn.
But I think that is, no, but this is indicative of a larger sort of philosophical problem or of a question, because it's out there, you know. AI is built in to various systems, And it has been, frankly, for a long time.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
the recommendation algorithms are also a form of machine learning and mm-hmm. so forth, much less sophisticated than LLMs. But
well, I mean, it's
been there for over a decade.
Since the 50s. Like this is like it's been in development for a long time. The tendency to anthropomorphize and like think that a machine has empathy for you is called the Eliza effect, which was like coined in the 70s or something mm-hmm. like this. So like even like the idea of like an AI therapist, which people are sort of up in arms about as well.
Yeah.
And I actually know people who use ChatGPT to like work out their problems with their girlfriend before they have a serious talk with their girlfriend, which I think is incredibly perverse. But like all of this is not new at all. But the fact that people, you know, it's mass adoption and like the scale. I mean, this is the scaling in yeah. Silicon Valley. The scale, the dramatic exponential scaling is new.
Yeah.
Because I think this actually goes back to like the core of the problem, which is like you can't trust like these things on a mass scale. Like you can trust them like maybe with people who are sort of like developing them for like good reasons, but like you can't trust like millions of people who want to be writers to not use this cheating tool
yeah.
to like write a book. There was a New York Times article a couple of months ago that said that there is a surge in self-published books and in book production, and between 2024 and 2025 people self-published a million more books than they had the year before.
It's slop.
It's also just like someone said, oh, she uses AI to write 200 romance novels a year or something like this. Like, what's the point? No one even likes reading. Do you know what I mean? This is what I don't understand. No one wants to read 200 books in a year. But it's a scale thing.
In an interesting way, the problem of the prize story of the Commonwealth Prize is analogous to that of any teacher or professor who is giving writing assignments. And we have a piece coming up by the philosopher Lily Hu, mm-hmm. who's at Yale, and she writes about the use of AI in analytical philosophy. And interestingly for me, I wasn't aware of that. She says that, I mean, analytical philosophy in particular has a negative attitude towards writing anyways.
Yeah. Have you ever read any pieces by analytical philosophers? Incredibly dispiriting.
Yes, I studied mostly continental, and it's a while ago. But so the idea is that it's all about making points, and that basically, yeah, it's like a very formulaic kind of language. And then the writing that happens in between the points that you make, why not outsource it to a writing assistant? And she's trying to put some resistance on what she feels is an enormous amount of peer group pressure, actually, mm-hmm. from her fellow philosophers, analytical philosophers, who are all like AI maxing. And
I know some academics who are AI. They're not maxing, but they're AI moderating.
AI moderating. Sure. Well, that's what she's trying to do. And then the other point, of course, is that she speaks also from the point of view of a teacher, and obviously any sort of like homework exercise assignment that she gives to her students, she can be most likely going to be AI essays that will be handed in. So the forms of evaluation and of academic culture are also changing. And if you want to make sure that people actually read and have digested and metabolized the points that their papers are making, mm-hmm. you need to evaluate them orally.
Yeah, or with a blue book, right?
Yeah.
Blue book is in the US, so it's a handwritten exam where you write an essay and they're blue, so we call them blue books.
Well, that's how I did all my exams in
Yeah, I mean, school. I did them in that's what I did in university as well. I also think like it's interesting because in my generation there was a real skepticism of using Google like at all. Or using like Wikipedia, like you shouldn't like there was this kind of primacy mm-hmm. about using like physical books and going to the library and using the Dewey Decimal System. The thing is, the people were still using it all the time, right? And what happened was there was a style of writing in English, at least, that arose like during the 2010s, which was very heavily influenced by Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of encyclopedia, like very broad, general, like clicking around kind of structure. And also the style of writing was very straightforward. Maybe they weren't plagiarizing from Wikipedia, mm-hmm. but they were writing as if for some kind of mass, curious, but fundamentally like not that literate like person, right? Mm-hmm. Even if they're describing really complicated concepts that even though the research was kind of like doing this rabbit hole thing where they were like bringing in like all different kinds of weird, like unusual references and stuff. And I'm not against that kind of research like at all, as long as you kind of evaluate what you produce using like traditional fact-checking means. But the thing I wanted to say is like people wrote like the way that technological advancement works is like humans came up with Wikipedia. They created a Wikipedia style of writing and a Wikipedia sort of network, right? And then people started using Wikipedia and then they mimicked the thing that humans had made, which they had done to seem sort of like, to make it seem like a robot or make it seem automatic, right? Yeah. And so the same thing I think will happen with AI, which is why I think writers like Sam Chris and I and, you know, Senecal, like sort of there's a fatalism that surrounds the topic, is that it's not just that everyone's using AI and it's going to be surrounding us, like everything is going to be written in this kind of like manic, like saucy tech world way, but it's also that like people are going to start writing like that naturally because they also don't read anything else. So then they're going to start writing like that and no one is going to be able to see, like, you know, the old way where we were like, oh, the sentence needs to have some kind of special verb, like some unique relationship to language, yeah. You know? And, you know...
I don't know. I don't know if that is the most likely scenario. I don't know if the analogy between Wikipedia and AI, LLMs, really works, because have you ever tried to... edit or create a Wikipedia article?
No.
The amount of friction.
Oh yeah, of course.
The amount of friction that the system, that the pretty extremely ingenious.
It's a great system.
Wikipedia editing community system has put into getting things into the actual pages. It's so tedious and long, and there are so many checks.
Yeah,
and,
but you're being a little bit German about this. I'm not being literal.
And But the point I want to make is that I think. In some way, like all the human work that went into creating, maintaining, expanding, editing, and all this friction that went into the Wikipedia article, somehow shows in the end product. And I want to be optimistic about the fact that human readers will sort of like derive more value from that than from the effortless creation of infinite amounts of text via LLMs.
The thing about AI or LLMs is that they are made to limit the amount of quote-unquote work the user has to do and to limit the amount of work that the user has to see, right? So there is no sense of like the vast technological advancement that is behind these things. It's supposed to be frictionless, formulaic, and it knows on some level that you want to produce a text that is hitting certain bullet points, like it's doing, like, you know, has core values, right?
Yeah.
So I think, like, they're not the same. I don't mean that they're the same, but I mean that the principle of we get this technology and writers then mimic the technology, kind of like, you know, I also use Wikipedia, like I don't really use Wikipedia, but like, you know, I've certainly read a Wikipedia article before, but I try really hard not to write like that in that tone, right? Yeah. Lots of people don't feel that way, right? Lots of people are like, this is how writing should be. And they will feel the same way about the writing that is produced by LLMs. And it does make you feel like incredibly fatalistic because you're like, I don't want to be confronted with this all the time.
Yeah.
So you're the editor of a magazine.
Yeah.
You get a lot of submissions. You're very busy. You're wearing a lot of hats.
Yes.
And you still, like, you know, as anger and scrutiny around this issue increases, there's only more pressure to make sure that you don't publish something that has been plagiarized by AI. Like, does it bother you? Does it worry you?
So if we go back to the Commonwealth story, the Commonwealth Prize scandal, some people are sure that this is AI, others didn't detect it. And going forward, we will see probably a situation where it's becoming harder and harder to tell. Now you're asking me as a magazine editor of Berlin Review, what do I make of this? How do I make sure that the stuff that's getting submitted is not written by AI? I would say that in the specific case of the magazine that we are doing, we're mostly interested in a specific style of like cultural criticism and writing. And that's the case of a lot of magazines. I mean, you've been edited by a number of magazines. We also have a certain idea of a house style. Mm-hmm. So I think we are less likely to be duped by... We do occasionally also publish literary writing, but very, very few of it. So to a certain degree, trying to iron out and streamline pieces in the editorial process as we do it as human editors is, I think... unfortunately, a process that is prone to being more and more emulated also by AI.
Yeah, well, also I think something we didn't talk about is people who use AI as like a starting point, right? And then they edit it, what it produces, to like make it sound like more human or like add their own like twist on it. I think that's actually much more common than like a purely AI generated story.
I mean, I will also say something as a non-native speaker of English whose working language is, I don't know, 50% of my work is in English and the other half is in German. I wasn't educated in the American or British or English-speaking academic system also.
Yeah.
And so many people we work with and who are good writers in principle, but they are not stylistically at the level as someone like you would be or a person who has done an MFA in an English language. So for that vast, actually a majority of the English people who work and write in English, the use of technology to like make sure that at least what you're saying is not outright wrong or is sort of like standard, using it as a simple proofreader is, I think, a different use case than giving it just a few bullet points and then having it write your text.
Yeah, of course. And also,
and then, but the problem is this is really, it's a slippery slope, of course.
Yeah.
And it is ultimately down to the responsibility or the work ethic or whatever, like the self-conception of any writer, how far they want to go in using the technology.
Well, this is interesting because I was wanted to ask about translation, right? Of course, anyone who lives in a country where they don't speak the native language
relies on translation,
is relying on Google Translate and the technology is getting really a lot better than it used to be. I remember like when you would use it, it's wonderful. Nevertheless, like it's
but it
still
tones down. I mean, I can speak a lot about that because part of my professional life in the last 15 years was also as a translator, as a money job. And the Google Translate is notoriously worse than the German startup DeepL.
Yeah, DeepL.
And it's also a sort of like unspoken secret that everyone in culture is using DeepL for at least first drafts translations. Of course, also do that, but it depends very much on the nature and the kind of text that you're trying to that you're translating, how good the DeepL draft then is. I would guess at this point a majority of professional translators, certainly not in poetry, maybe not in literature, but if it's about like functional text, non-fictional text, cultural institutions that have to produce catalog texts and all that kind of stuff. If that stuff gets translated, most of the professionals use DeepL for the first draft and then they post edit. And the question is that inherently problematic? Does it change the way language works? I think it does have an effect on the German language because in culture, the work language increasingly is English and I think stylistically, our friend Vincenzo Latronico wrote about this over a decade ago about international art English, a sort of like international style that has emerged. And the thing with this kind of English is that it's a very denotative kind of writing. It's like saying plain sentences. And if you machine translate that into German, the German that comes out of it is very, very dull.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have the usual syntactical variations that you have in the German language where you can put other parts of the sentence to the front and so forth. And so in that way, I think via machine translation from an already sort of like leveled down type of English, this is affecting...
The thing too is style. I think that it still creates kind of like weird things, right? Even now, like
there are real glitches,
not even glitches, just like sort of in sort of pretentious 20th century magazine editing, they would call them infelicities, right? It just like sounds a bit weird. international art English is kind of like a literally like weird thing where if you're a native English speaker and you hear, I think the example that I heard someone use last Berlin Biennale was the positions that the art takes, like the positions.
God, yes. So,
but I mean, we would never say that. But they, but you know, also it's like not, it's not any non-native English speaker's fault. Like you don't know, like what we
maybe
don't
this
say.
Is a, this is a retro contamination from German because this is how, what German curators always say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They
but
don't
it's
speak
like,
about individual artists. They
say
speak
the positions.
Position.
Yeah. And, but I mean, there's, you know, sort of, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Where is that coming from? It's kind of an interesting, like, if you're interested in language, like these kind of infelicities or like mistakes that maybe are going to be ironed out by the use of machine translation are like interesting for me. I've always loved English as a second language. I love the way that Germans speak English like naturally.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. It shows you a lot of things about your language. And there's something also interesting, which I wanted to bring up in the context of AI in general, which is that now many people are like leaving spelling or grammar mistakes in, for example, their Hinge profiles, their dating app profiles. Also, like I just did like an application for something, and you kind of want to make it clear some way
authentic.
That you didn't use AI. So you put in a mistake.
Mm.
Like a mistake that AI wouldn't make, as opposed to like a word usage one, like a grammatical mistake that it just wouldn't make, and it demonstrates that you are like a human.
Yeah, and there was also this wave of sort of like using an AI program to humanize the text again and artificially via AI putting in some errors.
I mean, it's crazy. But it's just funny. I mean, also, I think if you're a literary writer, if you write a novel or fiction or something and you want to use like the different ways people talk and you want to write some dialogue, for example, like, of course you make people make mistakes in the way that they talk, right? Or like if you, we were going to talk about this Ben Lerner novel, which we never talked about, but like there's a particular voice that, like a voice of someone else that can't really be captured, like, it can kind of be captured by AI, but like not quite, not very well yet. And part of that voice is like the kind of mistakes people make. And when I say like, oh, I've always loved English as a second language, it's because I really like to see like the lineage of learning English, like in what the result, right?
Yeah.
And like those are particular mistakes that a native speaker wouldn't make. And it shows you something new about language.
Yeah. Yeah. So how, okay, Lauren, you've been a published writer for, I don't know, at least 10 or 15 years. You grew up in a literary world where AI texts were not omnipresent. But today, the number of self-published books that has been on the market in the last 4 years has like exploded. And there's so many more people now apparently trying to become writers. And the bottleneck is the same as ever and much more streaming into it. So it's likely going to become ever more difficult for the people who are serious about writing to even break through. Do you think that is the case?
Well, yes and no, because I think if you're creating like my writing in particular, like a rather niche product that ideally, like if you're a literary writer, you kind of corner a small market.
Yeah.
And like that's how you know, there's like, you know, people are reading magazine articles. Sometimes there's still a viral magazine article. If you sell 5,000 copies of a book in your first year, that's considered a huge success in literary publishing specifically. I think for a long time, there has been a category error in talking about publishing or books in general, because realistically, you know, maybe I can trick some of the people who read self-published romantasy novels on Amazon.com into buying my novel by using like a really sassy, like sexy synopsis. And I'm not opposed to that. Like, I'm like, if someone buys my novel accidentally thinking it's like some kind of like thriller and then they like discover something that they might like about it, that's fine. Also, like, money's money, buy it. I don't care. That's fine. But like, really, I think you can think of it as almost like a local market, right? Where it's like the restaurant down the street doesn't need everyone from around the world to come there. It just needs like enough customers to sustain itself and to be kind of comfortable financially. And I think there are lots of people who have this weird resentment that like they're, you know, there are lots of literary writers or, you know, kind of like high culture producers, and they are resentful that they have some imagined idea of like the past when everybody was reading. And, you know, actually, I think the complaint that people aren't reading serious books has been around for a really long time. And like, there's been like a huge market for it. And you know, like, the worst case scenario for the literary novel, as I see it, is that it's something like opera, and like opera sustains itself through patronage. Fine. I don't, you know, it's also very different from opera because the barrier to entry is much lower for both consumers and producers. But like,
if I look at it from the German perspective, I would say that independently of AI, something has happened, and it's to do with social media. Over the past, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, a lot of people in the literary world are not as much writers as they are broadcasters.
Yeah, well.
So the way to break through and become a published writer is actually, first of all, create a personality. This can be done via magazine pieces, but a lot of it is clearly a good performance on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And then make yourself look so interesting that literary agents will approach you and beg you to write a book.
Yeah.
It happens all the time.
And then they come to ghostwrite. There's another element of this.
And then what happens is that these writers, I'm not going to name names, but they will have a book because the book is the one item that allows them or their publisher or their agent to monetize in a tangible way the attention that they have.
It's also a legitimizing force
that they're harvesting, like, on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I think for the literary culture, for German literary culture, this has been terrible. I think this is luckily also a movement that is a little bit on the back foot now. Mm-hmm. And we've seen interesting choices for literary prizes. For example, last year's Buchpreis was awarded to a really, really high literary, stylistically innovative book.
Are you talking about this?
By Dorothe Elminger.
I've heard some bad things about
You've heard bad things about it? Well, maybe AI was responsible for all the complicated Konjunktiv 2 and Konjunktiv 1 that the book is written in. But I hope that we are sort of like over this hill a little bit. But so it goes back to, I mean, my main question is, like, I think the status of written text is really changing, and we somehow, and AI is contributing to it. AI is not the only reason for it, but I don't see any way in which, you know, this trend can be reversed.
Yeah, I mean, I also think for me personally, what it has made me do, and it's similar to, like, I work as a ghostwriter sometimes, and I have to write these kind of boring, straightforward, like, memoirs.
Yeah.
That then, they don't always get published the way that I write them anyway. It doesn't really matter. But that basically, like, it makes me much more experimental as a writer because I feel like I need to, like, get it farther and farther away from, like, a normal-seeming piece of writing. Mm-hmm. Doing formal experimentation specifically, like, there's just, you know, AI can't do that. Like, maybe you can tell it to do that and it can produce something that looks like that, but it just can't really, like, produce a literary text that is making an argument through its form, right? Mm-hmm. It can't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just don't know how it could do that, because that requires an ability to actually read and not just input-output literature. So for me, that's kind of fun. And, like, there's a kind of anyone who's vaguely optimistic about this is like, oh, maybe it means that the actual literary people will just start getting weirder and weirder, and, like, the weirdness and experimentation will be more rewarded because it's so different from the status quo AI type stuff.
Okay, to wrap up, sometimes or often we do recommendations. We didn't want to recommend any.
I have a good book, actually.
You have a good book on AI?
The book I would like to recommend is Empire of AI by Karen Howe, who's a tech journalist who did a lot of work on OpenAI and AI companies for many years, and then produced this book, because I do think if you want to understand how the technology is working and how it is going to affect our society and how it is affecting our society in ways that you don't even notice yet, you have to understand what's at stake from a capital perspective, and what, like, what are the motives of these companies, like, how are the companies operating? And she does a really good job of explaining that, the kind of, like, eyebrow raising anecdotes that one loves to hate reading. Yeah,
all right. Yeah. I've, in preparation for this episode, I went back to read Nick Bostrom's book Superintelligence from 2014, which sort of, like, launched the discussion about the singularity and super intelligent AI taking over world control. And what's interesting about this book is that it's mostly actually a theological discussion, mm-hmm. which reminded me of philosophy classes on Descartes and on Immanuel Kant.
Maybe we should just go back to Descartes, actually.
I think it's worth doing it because there are a lot of things, problems that he tries to solve that we are confronted with now. But another thing, I think a question that we could discuss on another occasion is whether AI can be funny.
I mean, can it be funny? Like, there's this guy on Instagram who's really, really funny, whose handle I can't remember. I'll look it up and we can put it somewhere. But you've probably seen his videos where he has this really flat affect. He's a blonde guy and he's like, here's what happens when I tell AI I'm being hit by a car. And he's like, I'm being hit by a car. And then the AI is like, oh, no. You know, like he does really, really funny, really, really funny conversations with the AI that the AI obviously is not intending. It can't intend to do anything. But it's not supposed to be funny. But the disconnect between what you expect from, like, a super intelligent robot and that result, which is often, like, moronic and, like, doesn't, you know, the impossibility of understanding is what creates the humor. And it is, like, still a human, like, using the tool to create humor. But I mean, this is an interesting question. Like, in order to be funny, like, do you have to be intentional? And this is why I thought, like, oh, you know how children are funny. Yeah. They don't know. Like, they're making, like, a sex joke, but they don't understand the innuendo. They think they're just saying something. And you're, you know, the adults are laughing. Is that the same thing? Like, I don't have an answer.
We'll find out.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Haha.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read more about the future of culture in the age of AI, a recent issue includes an essay by the writer and researcher Ines Marchi on image manipulation and propaganda. It's called AI Uglies. You can find Ines's essay and all our reviews and podcast episodes at blnreview.de. Wherever you're listening, please take a moment to subscribe to Airlift. Give us a like and positive review. It actually does help. This episode was edited by Caitlin Roberts. I'm Tobias Haberkorn, editor of Berlin Review. See you next time.